If you imagine the trail through the Gospel of Mark as a hike up a tall mountain, it might go something like this. The first several chapters are rolling foothills. Our walk is almost easy at first. Certainly invigorating. The air is clean and rich with oxygen. We see Jesus being baptized, calling his disciples, starting to heal some people, casting out demons. We catch glimpses of his power, and we know that something exciting is afoot. We think it might stretch us, and we're happy to be a part of it. Then some controversies start. The sea crossings start, back and forth, back and forth. And we realize that it's getting a little tougher. Not everyone is pleased with the gospel that Jesus is proclaiming. The foothills are getting taller. They're starting to tax us more, and we realize that we're not in the shape that we once were or that we wish to be. We're even told that the Pharisees are making plans with the Herodians to kill Jesus. Still, we're happy to be along because the elevation is increasing, the scenery is very nice, even if we're starting to tire. Then we get to a rocky area that demands a little bit more of us. Peter confesses that Jesus is the Christ, but we soon realize that his understanding of what the Christ is all about is all wrong. Jesus starts talking about how he has to suffer and die and be raised again. Then Jesus comes back after the transfiguration to begin to head toward Jerusalem. We realize that we've reached a halfway point in Mark and that our trail has turned a corner. But instead of continuing a gentle trek, we're staring at the sheer face of a cliff with a rope ladder leading up. If we want to continue, it's going to get more difficult and more dangerous. The air is going to get thinner, the footing a little less secure. Perhaps the same is true not only of reading through Mark's gospel, but about the Christian life in general. Such is the sense that we get as we enter the scene in the reading this morning. After all, Jesus seems to go on the offensive against his disciples. Remember, Jesus is coming back down the mountain after the magnificence of the transfiguration. I'm sure that Peter is just itching to tell the others what just happened. But there's a scene, there's a commotion, some arguing, and Jesus goes right at them with three questions. What are you arguing about with them? You faithless generation, how much longer must I be among you? How much longer must I put up with you? It is yet another encounter with yet another demon-possessed person. This time it's different. The disciples have been unable to help. Now remember back in chapter 3, when Jesus appointed the 12, he had given them authority to cast out demons. And in chapter 6, when he sent them out two by two, it says he gave them authority over unclean spirits, and that they did cast out many demons, and anointed with oil many who were sick, and cured them. But now something has changed. It's gotten more difficult. This time it is a boy with a demon that has made him deaf and mute, and a father who is at his wit's end. You can almost hear the panic in his voice. Teacher, I brought you my son. He has a spirit that makes him unable to speak. And whenever it seizes him, it dashes him down. and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. And I ask your disciples to cast it out, but they could not do so. After Jesus' frustration with his disciples, his answer is very easy to overlook. Bring him to me. Bring the boy to Jesus. He does not ask the Father what else he has done to try to get the demon out. He does not ask the disciples what they did wrong. He doesn't ask the disciples what they tried, how they tried to get rid of this demon. There is but one next step. Bring the boy to Jesus. It doesn't have to be a demon that makes one unable to speak, or a demon that seizes or dashes down, or causes foaming or grinding of teeth. Some demons are not so overt or so blatant, but we can still see their work. In families torn apart by addiction, in people struggling to find work, in adolescents struggling to find their identity in a culture that has so many false answers, in men and women unable to escape the iron grip of guilt and shame, or in news of a father shot dead in a traffic scuffle, or news that the cancer is inoperable, or that the signs of dementia are increasing, or news that the car was unable to stop on the black ice and slid into the path of the oncoming semi. But the next step is always the same. Bring the boy to Jesus. Jesus does not leave the Father out of it. When Jesus asks him how long this has been going on, he cries, "From childhood. It has often cast him into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you're able to do anything, have pity on us and help us." If you are able, you can almost picture Jesus' raised eyebrow. If you are able, all things can be done for the one who believes. Jesus is not afraid here to indicate that the problem is some lack of faith. This passage and passages like it have been abused by those who would say to those who are ill or who are suffering, or to those around them, that the reason that they still suffer is because of their lack of faith. That if only they had a deep enough faith, their prayers would have been answered and healing would have come. It's hard to imagine anything more cruel. From what we read here, it is clear that faith and belief have something to do with healing. But Jesus is not discerning between those who have faith and those who do not, and healing those who do. He couldn't be. Nobody here in this scene has enough faith. Nobody. Not the disciples, not the great crowd, not the scribes arguing, not the Father. Nobody has enough faith, and yet the boy is healed. Jesus doesn't tell the man to try harder to believe. Jesus doesn't tell the man to go away and then to come back when he believes a little bit more. The Father immediately cries out, "I believe. Help my unbelief." What a profound prayer. It is a prayer that might seem strange to us moderns, maybe even paradoxical. We're tempted to think of belief as something that we come to after we examine the evidence. We're tempted to think of belief as something that we decide on. We're tempted to think of belief as something that we summon from deep within ourselves. But any belief that we have is a gift from God. Any deeper belief that we get is also a gift. And it is a gift that comes when we encounter Jesus. Bring him to me. Bring the boy to Jesus. One writer puts it this way about this worried father. He understands that this rabbi standing before him is capable of reaching into his heart and transforming him. The church has long viewed worship as the way we bring someone to Jesus, now that he has ascended and is seated at the right hand of the Father. Kathleen Norris writes about how worship, how hearing the word read and proclaimed, hearing and participating in the hymns and the psalms, the prayers of the church and the creeds, was a major instrument in her conversion. But she tells of an incident that makes her worry that in this she is a bit of an anachronism today. She writes, "I recently read an article that depicted a heated exchange between a seminary student and an Orthodox theologian at Yale Divinity School. The theologian had given a talk on the development of the Christian creeds. The student's original question was centered on belief. What can one do, he asked, when one finds it impossible to affirm certain tenets of the creed? The priest responded, well, you just say it. It's not that hard to master. With a little effort, most can learn it by heart. She continues, to learn something by heart is a concept more in tune with the ancient world than with our own. And the student, apparently feeling that he had been misunderstood, asked with exasperation, what am I to do when I have difficulty affirming parts of the creed, like the virgin birth? And he got the same response. You just say it, particularly when you have difficulty believing it. You just keep saying it. It will come eventually. The student raised his voice. How can I, with integrity, affirm a creed in which I do not believe? And the priest replied, it's not your creed. It's our creed, meaning the creed of the entire Christian church. Norris writes, I can picture the theologian shrugging, as only the Orthodox can shrug, carrying so lightly the 1,000-plus years of their liturgical tradition. Eventually, it may come to you, he told the student. For some, it takes longer than others. Bring the boy to Jesus and pray. Jesus pulls all of this together in a private scene with the disciples back at the house. Not surprisingly, the disciples want to know why they couldn't cast it out. They used to be able to. He shakes his head. This kind can come out only through prayer. Bring the boy to Jesus and pray. Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. The last thing that Jesus does before he retreats with his disciples to the house is to take the young boy by the hand. Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he was able to stand. The hymn that we will sing at the close of worship today is a hymn for someone about whom Jesus says, "Bring him to me." It is a hymn that cries out, I believe, help my unbelief. It is a hymn from the lips of someone needing the Lord's hand. The hymn's writer, Tommy Dorsey, back in the 1930s, was 32 years old and was a relatively new husband, living with his wife, Nettie, on the south side of Chicago. They were expecting the birth of their first child, but Tommy had to go to St. Louis, where he was singing as a soloist for a large revival meeting. Because the due date for the baby was approaching, he didn't want to go, but a lot of people were expecting him in St. Louis. He writes, "I kissed Nettie goodbye, clattered downstairs to our Model A, and in a fresh Lake Michigan breeze, chugged out of Chicago on Route 66. However, outside the city, I discovered that in my anxiety about leaving, I had forgotten my music case. When he went back, he found Nettie sleeping peacefully. He hesitated, feeling like something was telling him to stay. But not wanting to disturb her, he collected his music and left quietly. The next night, when he sat down after having sung song after song at the revival, a messenger boy ran up with a telegram. Ripping open the envelope, he read the words, 'Your wife just died. Come home.' He says that though people were happily singing and clapping around him, he could hardly keep from crying out in anguish. He rushed to a phone and called home, and the news was confirmed. And when he got home, he learned that Nettie had given birth to a boy, but that night, the baby died as well. He was crushed. He felt that God had done him an injustice. He didn't want to serve God anymore. He wanted to go back to the blues clubs. He didn't know what to believe. A week or two later, he found himself at the piano keyboard in the music room of his college, having been brought there by an old professor friend. He said that something happened and he felt at peace, as though he could reach out and touch God. Then he said, the words, like drops of water from the crevice of a rock above, seemed to drop in line with me on the piano. Precious Lord, take my hand. Lead me on, let me stand. I am tired, I am weak, I am worn. Through the storm, through the night, lead me on to the light. Take my hand. Precious Lord, lead me home. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.